Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 12:25 p.m. That is Pacific Standard Time. Today is Friday and it is January 19th. And of course, being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And I want to talk today, at least to start off with demographics, because when we think about what are the three primary long-term themes that really animate this service and that we kind of center our long-term thoughts about, then one is the rise of the global consumer. And this is, I think, a very important chart because it tells us where the majority of the global population growth is going to come from in the coming decades. And this is as of 2017, and we can see it's beautifully colored. So Africa is where the vast majority of people are being born. And that means that all of the factors being equal, between 15 and 20 years from now, there is going to be a massive swell in the working age population of Africa right across the boards, most particularly right there in the center around the DRC. And what that also suggests is that there is a potential benefit, at least for a demographic dividend. Well, demographic dividends don't necessarily translate into economic growth. What you need is improving governance. And when we look at different countries and what they did to really capitalize on their demographic dividends, well, we get a number of different potential outcomes. In China, for example, they went for the export model and infrastructure development and central planning. And what that has delivered has been an infrastructure build quite beyond anything that has ever been seen in human history. The pace of the infrastructure development that they have had is quite beyond recognition. And then they have moved on to digitalization of the economy and creating a consumer-led boom that many people didn't think was possible. If you remember back maybe 5 or 6 years ago, people were very much of the opinion that Chinese people were not consumers, that they were primarily savers, that they were not willing to go out and spend their money because and they have very high savings rates. Well, my argument at the time was that it was probably much more likely to, or much more appropriate to compare the Chinese growth trajectory to that of the USA, to compare India with the UK, for the simple reason that you have central planning in China, where every city, for example, has a central railway station, and it's very similar in the UK, in the USA, where you have a grid system, whereas in India, it is very much privately, private enterprise is driving infrastructure development and innovation. That's certainly that remains the case. And when you look at London, for example, the fact that there is no central railway station, that there were a large number of privately owned railways, and that the city is dotted with central with very large railway stations, each representative of the headquarters of a private railway operation from back in the 1800s, is representative of the private sector-led growth of the railway sector in the UK. So that's why I've thought for a long time that the best way to think about the growth trajectory of India would be to look at how things happened within the UK and to look at China from the perspective of what happened in the USA. Well, China has developed a consumer-led expansion over the last 3 or 4 years that is quite startling to witness. And that's particularly the case because I've been going to China since 2005, and back then you could get nothing done without carrying wads of cash around with you, whereas today large numbers of ATMs don't have any cash in them at all. You simply do not need cash for the vast majority of transactions. In fact, a lot of shops don't want to take cash because of the the risk of counterfeiting, and the ease with which they can accept online payments or mobile payments. And what this has contributed to is this massive swell in the consumer economy. The fact that you can now buy online just about anything, that you have an army of delivery people that bring restaurant quality food to your home, and that all of this is and that the quality of service, which is certainly not anything that anyone ever anticipated that China would excel at, has improved beyond recognition because of the review system. So we know that there are ample examples of countries that have got it right, that a demographic dividend can transform a country from the relative sticks that where no one ever thought that that innovation or economic growth was possible into growth drivers. I posted a chart in last week's video of India being among the highest growth of all economies, and the other high growth economies were all in Africa. And of course, because they're coming off of such low bases, well, then we know that it is much easier to double from 1 to 2 than it is from 1,000 to 2,000. So they do have the base effect working very much in their favor. But one thing that's important with regard to India, and I do apologize to any of our Indian subscribers that I'm about to butcher their language, but there are two important terms that really do stand out. One is Jan Dhyan, and now that was an initiative that that was launched back in 2014, and the entire aim of it was to ensure that every household in India has a bank account. So they've opened 285 million bank accounts in the last 3 years, and that's an incredible achievement. But what it does is that it opens up the banking sector to hundreds of millions of people, because that is 285 million accounts. So that's only for every household. When you start multiplying that by the number of people in the household, you get some rather profound numbers. So what that does is when you open up the financial sector to people, well, then they get to save money in a more secure environment. They get to earn interest, and because India generally has somewhat higher interest rates, then they have the compounding effect. Then, of course, you have the potential for credit, and with credit, then you can invest, and with you can build businesses. So that is even all on its own, that's really quite an incredible development. And I think it is worth highlighting, for example, that the Bombay Banks Index was at a new high in here today. And it has been trending higher in a pretty consistent manner for much of the last year. But I think it is really worth looking at this on a long-term logarithmic scale, because when we do it on that basis, we can see, for example, that even in times of extraordinary stress, like the financial crisis, that it bounced back in an incredibly robust fashion, and it was at a new all-time high by the time we got to the end of 2010. The Indian banking sector is potentially on the cusp of really quite profound growth, since they now have 285 million new customers that they simply did not have before. So that's something that is really something that is going to be a big point in India's favor over the coming 5 or 6 years. Then there is this additional point, and it's another Indian term. It's Aadhaar. And I again apologize for butchering the pronunciation, but this was an initiative started back in 2010. And what it has done is collected biometric data from all 1.3 billion people. It's taken 7 years. They've taken fingerprints and retinal scans of everybody in India. And by doing that, what I think one of the primary way objectives was for voter registration. But what it also does is it creates incredible fuel for the app-based economy. Because when you start putting all of this biometric data and digitizing it, then people can have mobile access to their bank accounts, because most of the new smartphones have biometric fingerprint analysis built in. So therefore, people get online banking. Then the rollout last year of, well, I think it was perhaps more at the in December of 2016 by Reliance Industries of its 4G network. Well, the 4G network was an incredible step up for the vast majority of people in India, because what it represented was a move from 2G to 4G. And I think we can all remember what 2G felt like. It was incredibly slow. It was almost slow to the point of unusability. And the upgrade to 4G makes so much more possible. So when you have these, when you have the private investment of the money and capital required to build a 4G network for the entire company, laid on top of the state-based infrastructure of the rollout of banking, and also then the collection of biometric data, and layer on top of that the pace of technological innovation, where voice recognition software has improved really quite considerably in the last decade, then you have the foundations for a profound change in the Indian economy. And we already know that China has been able to achieve this rollout of an internet-based commercial economy in the last 4 or 5 years, and there is absolutely no reason why a similar evolution can't also take place in India. Tata Consultancy is the largest holding within the information technology sector of India, and it is breaking upwards to new highs in here this week. Considering that it had been going sideways for the last 3 years, this is really quite an impressive breakout, and it does suggest that the information technology sector in India is about to start getting headlines once more. So when we think about what the long-term perspective is, then India is, I think, next in line to benefit from the digitization theme. So when we then think about going back to somewhere like Africa, which is so far behind India in terms of its development, that the chances are that within the next 20 years, Africa will probably be where India is today. And that is obviously not going to be universally true, something that many people, and it is certainly something that is very easy to overlook, is that Africa is a continent, not a country, and that there are bright spots of innovation and bright spots of manufacturing and improving governance right across the continent that give one hope, and not least because some of these are very high growth population countries, not least in Ethiopia. And we're already seeing that the textile sector is moving into these countries. So with the arrival of textiles, then you have the building blocks for an export-led development model, because the textile market often is the first of the manufacturing sectors to move in, because they are so focused on razor-thin margins and the lowest possible labor cost. So when we think about it in those terms, we are, despite the fact that in the West, everyone is now getting a little bit more wary about being bullish of globalization, that what a problem that a lot of people have is that we have had decades of globalization, which has ignited really quite impressive economic growth right across the emerging markets. But I think the flip side of that is that it has been achieved by sacrificing the living standards of middle-class people in much of the developed world, so that wages have been largely static for decades, the cost of living has been increasing, and the evolution of business models has very much contributed to the rise of the subscription-based economic model, which and in here today, Amazon is raising the price of its Prime product by a fairly substantial percentage move. So what that is confirming is that there is a belief that when we think about technology and the role of technology in consumer discretionary, that a large number of technology companies are not so much technology companies any longer. That it is, I think, quite appropriate to think of Amazon as a consumer discretionary company, because when we think about it, there is a clear signal that it is dominating the consumer discretionary sector, and it is doing so by leveraging its subscription model. One of the points that has often been leveled at the technology sector is that it's highly cyclical. And when we look at the parts of the technology sector that are cyclical, then they are returning to dominance right now. So, for example, the semiconductor sector is still a cyclical sector. And I need to get a bit better with my typing. So, for example, the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index has taken out its 2000 peak, and it's been rallying very impressively since 2016. And semiconductors are a cyclical sector because there's nobody selling subscriptions to a semiconductor. But people sell, then you look at the very large companies like Amazon, which has Prime, and Microsoft, which has its Microsoft 365, Office 365. Then Autodesk has adopted the subscription model for its graphics software. Adobe has adopted the subscription model for Photoshop. And when you start stringing those together, well, these are no longer technology companies. These are consumer discretionary companies. And they continue to do very well. Well, what all of this move into subscriptions has created has been a drive towards just looking for slices of the consumer's monthly income. So Blue Apron was able to IPO, and Grays has been bombarding me with news and with offers since we took up a free trial and quickly cancelled it. Then you had Juicero, which went bust earlier in 2017. These are all representative of the subscription model moving out into the consumer market. The Dollar Shave Club would be another example of that. Now, what all of that has contributed to is a certain amount of pressure on the part of the consumer, that they have not seen their wages rising, but their cost of living have. And in order to sustain what is considered a reasonably high standard of living, then you need to have a higher wage because of all these slices of your wage that are being taken up by increasing numbers of subscription services. That even 25 years ago, not many people would have had a mobile phone, and now everybody does, but it represents another subscription model. It's almost like a utility. And the subscription model does give way to these less lumpy cash flows, which means they're much more desirable from the corporate standpoint. They're much easier to model, and therefore it tends to create this rather benign outcome in terms of their share price, because from a fundamental basis, if the cash flows are easier to model, then a higher valuation is usually justifiable. Well, all of that is contributing to demands for higher wages, and so far it has been a relative trickle. But what we are seeing is that there is increasing demand for inflation hedges. And US 10-year Treasury yields are at 2.6, almost 2.65%. This represents the peak that we saw back at the beginning of last year. Now, there is a short-term oversold condition in the price, and I think my long might have been a little bit premature. I'm certainly not going to burn for the faith here. But the reality is that this is I think a clear downward break at this stage, and considering that the price at least had been ranging for the better part of 3 years, and we have already had a number of interest rate hikes, so obviously the yield is a more appropriate measure. But I think it is worth pointing out that the price is now lower than the lows that we saw at in the teeth of the taper tantrum. If 10-year yields are breaking out, then the next area of potential resistance is around 3%. And 3% is a big psychological level, because that's where a lot of bond investors will have been remembering that's where we had a substantial rally take place after the taper tantrum. But here, I think, is the much more important chart, and it is the total return chart, where we take price and yield into account. And there has been a marked loss of momentum over the course of the last 4 years. And when I just simply zoom in on that over just over the last decade, the total return index is sustaining the move below the trend mean. It is coming back down towards the lows that we saw in late 2016. And if we start to see it breaking those lows from 2016, well, then we're in a bear market. That we will then have had a completed Type 3 top formation. If it sustains the move below 2000, well, then we can conclude that the bear market is accelerating. And what that would suggest is that this desire by people for higher wages is an important arbiter, because what it represents is socially driven inflation. Now, we are also starting to see that because we are in the latter stages of a medium-term bull market, that cyclical sectors are picking up, and semiconductors fall into that category, but so do commodities. So the commodity sector remains in a recovery trajectory, and the FTSE 350 mining index has paused around the psychological 20,000 level, but the last time it traded in around here was back in 2012. So it's really quite a long time since then. We have a short-term overbought condition, so we could get some pause and consolidation, but this continues to look like a recovery trajectory. And of course, the most important of the commodities is oil, and oil prices have been steady around the $70 level for much of the last couple of weeks. What I find particularly interesting is the news flow. I've seen so many news items over the course of the last few days saying that oil has pulled back incredibly sharply, the rally is over. But all you have to do is look at the daily chart, and we can see that we have one range above another, that the price has not pulled back by more than $5 since at least June of last year. And so far, this reaction is less than $3. So, in fact, it's less than $2.50. So, what that suggests to me is that this is a pause, that in fact, the speed with which we've had a pullback this week has been so modest that it suggests that there isn't anybody panicking in the oil market, that this is simply a pause in the region of the psychological 70,000 level. And if we look back at the history of this trend since June, then Rangers can take anything up to 8 weeks, and more likely 4 weeks. So we are 5 days into a reaction, and prices could be going sideways for a while. But if we do not get a reaction of more than $5, then this remains a reasonably consistent advance. Now, we are still in this rather interesting period, because when we look at the long-term history of oil, and we're rather lucky that we can look at a very long-term price history, that if we go all the way back to the 1800s, then what we're presented with is a lengthy periods where prices don't do much of anything, and then decade-long periods where we get very impressive rallies. Well, the last big impressive rally was from the lows in the late 1990s up to the peak that we saw all the way back in 2008. And if history is any guide, and considering that we have more than 130 years of history, what it suggests is that we could go through a secular period where oil prices range. And the upper side of that range is close to $100, and the lower side is above 30. So there is the potential for prices to triple from trough to peak, but they are unlikely to trend higher, and they're unlikely to hold moves up towards the upper side of the range. And right now we are pretty close to the middle of the range. This is a very long-term chart. It is only updated monthly, so the last time it was updated was at the end of December. So the price is currently around 70s, which is almost exactly the middle of the range. We also know that part of the reason that the price has been able to get up to this level is because OPEC has been restricting supply ahead of the Saudi Aramco IPO. And once that IPO and has been successfully completed, and Saudi Arabia has got the money in its coffers, well, they don't have a great deal of incentive to continue to withhold supply from the market, and we could see prices come all the way back down. And of course, part of the reason for that is because now that prices are around $70, then what we have is an environment where a U.S. domestic supply is increasing once more, and the rig count is picking up. Now, what we can also see all the way out to that we have a rather substantial backwardation in the market. So what that tells us is that prices right now are well above where they are out in the future, which is indicative of a supply deficit. But when that begins to narrow, and it could be a while before it narrows, but when we start to see the prices at the long end of the curve coming back up towards the mid-$60, well, then there's going to be a lot of hedging activity taking place. And with that hedging activity, it means that the unconventional oil and gas drillers will be able to drill with impunity. And they will do exactly that. It will probably also coincide with the end of the supply restrictions on OPEC and Russia. And we could see prices come all the way back down to the lows. So that's why the trend in oil is, I think, really worth monitoring. It's still very consistent on the upside, because a significant number of the producers have an incentive in supporting prices. But we know that that is not always going to remain the case. And that is quite apart from the argument of for innovation within the energy sector. The pace of technological innovation, particularly in wind and solar, is occurring quite independently of what is happening in the energy sector. That is, I think, perhaps the most important point, that technological innovation is completely independent of the business cycle. That doesn't mean that equities are independent of the business cycle, but the pace of technological innovation is. And when we look at, for example, the solar shares, then they have been incredibly depressed because of the pace of technological innovation. I had I was playing mahjong with the CEO of First Solar in Vietnam over the weekend, and what this is that they are building out their manufacturing capacity in a number of different locations. What they're very confident about the market over the medium to long term. And what it also suggests is that companies that can survive in this very competitive environment are doing so because they can innovate. And the pace of innovation and the, I think when we look at the efficiencies that solar cells are achieving and the cost of achieving those efficiencies, that coal is a resource that is is looking to be increasingly in terminal decline. It is probably going to be quite some time before we get to the same point with oil. But battery innovation represents such an incredible prize that we are seeing huge in money being invested into achieving the kinds of efficiencies that will drive a, and I think, pardon the pun, but drive a complete innovation in autonomous and in electric vehicles. And these are the kinds of themes that can revolutionize an economy, that it is only within the next 3 or 4 years that we're likely to see the rollout of these kinds of technologies. So we are potentially seeing some of that being priced in already. And the fact that Tesla continues to attract investment, despite the fact that it continues to have manufacturing problems, is both representative of enthusiasm about the pace of technological innovation, and also it's a factor of just how much debt there is outstanding. That Tesla has got a B-minus rating, which is roughly equivalent to Ethiopia, and I suspect that Ethiopia is a surer bet over the long term, perhaps, than Tesla is. Well, when we think about it in those terms, then the NASDAQ is the home of a significant number of these technology companies, and it has pushed on to new all-time highs in rather impressive fashion over the last couple of years. It is now approaching the 7,000 level, and we've had brief pauses around big psychological levels in the past. So, and we know that there is a short-term overbought condition. What I think is very important to point out is that when we think about the long-term potential for countries like India, or the rise of the global consumer, and the demographic dividends that are likely to be bestowed on Africa over the course of the next 20 years, these are long-term themes, and there is absolutely nothing is going to stop hundreds of millions of young people growing up and entering the workforce short of a world war. And these are long-term themes, and they are the kinds of thing that will generate a secular bull market. The fact that we have oil prices that might be strengthening in the short term, but that are less likely to trend than range for the long term, and the pace of technological innovation, which is ramping up, and most particularly in terms of artificial intelligence, and with deep learning, with the rollout of the Internet of Things and faster internet connectivity, and the fact that we are increasingly moving towards 5G internet connectivity, and I think there is increasing acceptance that we need a new infrastructure build in terms of the kind of infrastructure and network capacity that is going to be required to support all of the new technologies. That 5G is going to be required if we're going to have autonomous vehicles. They're going to have to be able to communicate both with a central hub, with one another, and they're going to have to be able to to process all the information that they're gathering. This is the real promise of the digitization economy, that the quantity of data that's going to be accumulated by every device in our lives, and the potential then for that information to be parsed by supercomputers is, I think, it is the logical progression of the digitization economy. And that is going to help to drive economic growth everywhere. But the fact that because of globalization and a global market, that these technologies go global instantly, well, what that helps is for emerging economies to be able to leapfrog whole stages of development. It doesn't stop the need for things like ports and roads and electricity and water and sanitation and cities, but what it does help to do is revolutionize utilities. It helps to revolutionize communication and banking, and all of these factors help to drive economic growth. It has been abundantly clear that the time in which an economy can now move from abject poverty into middle income is progressing at a much faster rate. And the reason that that can happen is because of application and availability of technology. So these are the kinds of themes that are going to generate long-term value in the economy. So those are the secular themes, but we also have to think about the cyclical themes, and the cyclical themes are very much tied into the business cycle. So when we think about it in those terms, central banks have been flooding the global economy with capital now for almost a decade. A significant proportion of the debt that was taken out to fund that monetary largesse had 10-year maturities. So there is a great deal of debt that has got to mature at some point this year and next year. And that represents a significant source of additional supply in the bond markets, which is why we're getting this uptick in government bond yields. And we're getting increasing interest in the gold market. So, for example, the ETF holdings of gold moved to a new incremental recovery high yesterday. It's rather difficult to see on the long-term chart, but we can just about see it on the weekly chart. And that was despite the fact that gold prices were in slightly negative territory yesterday, and this was updated through yesterday's close. Well, people buy gold for two reasons. They buy it because the dollar is weak, and as a hedge against as a currency or as a monetary metal, and because all currencies are a ratio, when one goes down, the other goes up. But they also buy it as an inflation hedge. 10-year government bond yields have been ranging below approximately 2.65% since the beginning of last year, and gold prices have been ranging below $1,400 since the beginning or the middle of 2016. And perhaps we should be thinking about that as not so much as a coincidence, but a correlation. That in rising inflationary pressures, people tend to like gold because it has such a long-term history of holding its value as and its purchasing power. And it has got first step above the type 2 base formation characteristics. I've been saying that for more than a year already, and that is one of the hallmarks of these periods of right-hand extension. They can be lengthy, they can be very volatile, and they generally give way to us questioning the integrity of the potential upside. But ranges are explosions waiting to happen, and gold prices have been ranging. So there is the potential here that when gold prices do eventually break out, then they're going to rally in an impressive manner. And that isn't something that we've seen from gold in what feels like a very long time. So I think people have got to the point now where they have forgotten that one of the hallmarks of gold during the bull market was that it ranged for pretty lengthy periods and then broke out. And when it broke out, it rallied by hundreds of dollars. And then it ranged for another 18 months, and then it had these explosive breakouts. So we have ample, I think, evidence within the gold market that it is capable of doing this. And it has probably been ranging, perhaps not quite yet long enough, but it is looking increasingly likely that we are coming up towards the upper side of the range. And if it can hold this move, if it can consolidate in the region anywhere between $1,350 and $1,370, that will set us up for an impressive breakout. And it could coincide with a move higher in government bond yields. So I think gold is a potential hedge against rising inflationary pressures, particularly in the USA, because the USA has addressed this, I think, widening gap between rich and poor and demand for higher wages by adopting a deficit spending or a fiscal stimulus, whichever way you decide to categorize the tax cuts and changes to the tax code that have been introduced. So that's directly inflationary. And that is one way that this revolt against the status quo has manifested itself. Within the UK, you've had the rise of the Brexit movement and people wishing to take back control so that they have control of their own destiny, which with, of course, the aim of having a better standard of living. Well, Germany still doesn't have a government. Italy is going to have an election, and there are an increasing number of populist governments in Eastern Europe. And these are not simply coincidences, but rather they are a symptom of this dissatisfaction with the status quo and with the central bank response to the credit crisis. Because when we get down to the very base of the entire solution, it was to take private sector debt and to foist it upon the public purse, so that particularly in Europe, it was regular taxpayers were forced to pay the debts of some very large and silly bets that were taken in a whole range of different sectors. And what that has contributed to is a decade of underperformance. Well, when we look at Europe over, and not simply the Eurozone, but all of Europe on a stock market basis, it has been ranging for 17 full years already. And there is an increasing likelihood that it is about to break out. But of course, stock markets are also a hedge against inflation. And the reality is that bond markets don't like inflation because yields are fixed, but dividends aren't. And when you get back into an inflationary bias, companies recapture their pricing power. And generally, they use that as an opportunity to raise prices more than they would normally. And then they can pass on that benefit to their shareholders. So the stock markets tend to be a reasonably good hedge against inflation. And I think it is particularly important to just bear in mind what the very long-term chart of yields looks like, because we have been in a disinflationary period for what must feel like forever. That yields peaked in 1980, and they have been pretty much coming down since. So that is something that the vast majority of people have got experience of in their financial lives. Because, for example, if you were starting your career in the bond markets in 1980, you might have been 20 years old. So that means that today, you're probably close to 60 and therefore thinking about retirement. If you were had a senior position in 1980, well, then you've probably already retired. And since the average age of a trader is somewhere in their mid-20s, then they have no institutional memory and they have no personal memory of what an inflationary cycle looks like. But this falls almost, I think it is almost to the year when you think about the length of a Kondratiev wave, that Nikolai Kondratiev was thinking about 40-year cycles. And we have just had about that in terms of the disinflationary period from the 1980s. Well, what that suggests is that, and I think anyone who looks at this long-term chart, and it's a nominal scale chart, but you can see that the base formation has been in evidence since about 2011. We had an incremental move to new reaction lows, which was not sustained about 18 months ago, and now the price is pushing on again. Well, if we see a move back above 30, or excuse me, 3%, that is going to complete this base. And what that suggests then is that we are going to be back in a new inflationary cycle. Well, if that is indeed the case, there is no country that has been trying to foment inflation for longer than Japan. And when we look at the performance of the stock market on a logarithmic scale chart, it trended lower in an incredibly jerky manner until about 2010. And now we are back in a position where the index is trading at new recovery highs for the first time since 1992 was the last time it hit the 23,000 point level. This is a profound change. This isn't something that happens on its own. And Japan is running both fiscal and monetary stimulus, and they're not done yet. So what that suggests is that this is the country that could benefit most from a return to inflationary pressures, most particularly in terms of the stock market. And considering that if we're going to take this conclusion to its logical course, well, then the banking sector is where we're going to see some of the biggest changes, because banks have had zero margin for, again, what must feel like forever. When you have zero interest rates or negative interest rates, well, then banks just simply can't make any money. And banks have been in a depressed state for really quite a long time. If banks were performing at least as well as the Nikkei, well, then they'd be closer to 700 than 200. And so far, this index has held the move above 200. So what this suggests to me is that people are beginning to take notice of the Japanese banks. A question that I've asked, I think that it is an important question, and I'm not at all sure whether we can get a conclusive answer. But since we were in a period of disinflation all the way from the 1980s, which was, I think it probably started off because interest rates were so high, and then that killed off inflation. Then we had technological innovation. We had the rise of the consumer. We had globalization, then we had the end of the Cold War. All of these things contributed to disinflation. And now, when you think about what was Japan trying to do after their bubble burst in the late 1980s, well, they were trying to create inflation against a background of one of the most powerful disinflationary periods in history. Rather than think about how badly they failed to foment inflation, I think a better question is, could they possibly have succeeded? Well, since they've been trying for so long, then we may be coming to the period in time where inflationary pressures are starting to rise, and Japan is where we're starting to see the first signs of inflationary pressures resurfacing. If that's indeed the case, then the Japanese stock market, at least in nominal terms, could be where we have one of the best hedges against rising interest rates or rising yields most particularly. I think that that is at least a possibility that we have to give due consideration to. Well, obviously we know that we've had this period of extraordinary monetary stimulus. And what we now have is evidence of these cyclical sectors starting to return to performance. And we've looked at the semiconductor sector, we've looked at the commodities sector, then the banking sector, not just in Japan, but in the USA, is also returning to performance. And what I think that is suggestive of is also the return to performance of a cyclical sector. So cyclical sectors generally tend to do best in periods of synchronized global economic expansion, but synchronized global economic expansion usually happens at the end of a cycle. It represents the beginning of the maturing phase of a cyclical bull market, because when you get synchronized expansion, then central banks start to worry about overheating and they begin to remove some of the monetary stimulus. So we also now have evidence of acceleration starting to come through in the primary Wall Street indices. The pace of the advance on the Dow Jones has accelerated in the last 6 months. The pace of the advance was pretty impressive prior to about June of last year, or August of last year, but it has really picked up with the news of the tax cuts in the USA. And there's no evidence yet that it's over. But acceleration is a trend ending. And what that suggests is that when this eventually does end, and it represents the third psychological perception stage of the bull market, its cyclical sectors will probably keep going for longer, and we really do have to be careful about the consistency of the charts that are now leading on the upside. A rotation out of the big name technology shares would be, I think, another warning signal, because they have been such incredible leaders, and leaders tend to lead in both directions. So if we start to see concerted underperformance by companies like Google, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, then that's likely to inform us that we are coming again towards the latter stages of the acceleration phase. We are in the period of time now where money is easiest to make, and the markets rise fastest, so there is no reason yet to sell. But we know what we have to keep an eye on. We have to watch the consistency of trends. We should also be looking at high yield spreads, because high yield trades like equity, and high yield spreads are completely inert. There is no evidence of any warnings there. Unemployment rates generally start to rise before a recession, and there's no evidence of that either. So we're still in perhaps the best phase, the Goldilocks phase of this bull market. And while being aware of what the potential outcomes can be in terms of potential downside, that's unlikely to manifest itself until we see some of the lead indicators starting to roll over. And there's no evidence yet of lead indicators rolling over. And where we have the most acute signs of something rolling over is in Bitcoin. The price has pulled back violently since the middle of December. And what I'm reminded of is 1999. Where people have been giving up their jobs to start funds and to invest in in Bitcoin or in the cryptocurrencies. The pace of technological innovation is such that Bitcoin has had so many forks because its structure is so rigid. It is simply not capable of delivering upon what is demanded of it to become a global solution to a number of presumed and actual problems. The proof of work is giving way to the proof of stake way of mining, and then that is giving way to DAC. So what that suggests is that we're at a period now where Bitcoin could be I think compared to either AOL or Nextel, that they represented some of the best vehicles for playing the bubble phase in the 1990s. But then Google didn't IPO until 2005, Facebook until much later than that. Amazon was the company that came through as the primary beneficiary of the creation of the internet from that 1990s period. So when we look at it in those terms and look at the long-term potential of the blockchain, I think that the blockchain does have long-term potential for innovation in the financial sector and for leveling the playing field, particularly for the emerging markets in terms of access to credit and matching investors with entrepreneurs, and also for streamlining the global logistics sector, which is still reliant on large numbers of brokers and paper trails that certainly has the potential for I think profound change. But that does not mean that Bitcoin needs to be the vehicle to achieve that. I think that there, of the 200 or even 300 plus different crypto tokens, one is a Telegraph, and that ICO isn't even going to start until March of next year, but it's already oversubscribed at $2 billion for private messaging. So when we think about it in those terms, that the newer solutions are much more viable, they're much more elastic, and they have the potential to create some real value. I think that the Bitcoin bubble is over, that but blockchain will live on, and that it is the evolving blockchain market and the pace of innovation within it that is probably likely to drive the innovations that a lot of the promises have been centered on. I think that it is worth highlighting that in every major bull market, there are promises that are made. And usually the price goes way up before those promises are ever delivered upon. But the promises are delivered upon eventually. The promise of the TMT boom in the 1990s was that the internet would change our lives, and it has. But that did not stop us from going through a bubble and a bust. And I think that when you look at every bubble, it is exactly the same. The promises are in fact kept, but that it just takes much longer than anyone was willing to countenance during the bubble phase. And I suspect that that is exactly what we're going to have with cryptocurrencies. And there are some that have got real potential. I think that Ethereum has got more potential for innovation than Bitcoin does, that IOTA is out there on the horizon, but perhaps not yet capable of delivering upon its promise. And there are umpteen more. And because of the pace of technological innovation, then it is a topic that is likely to remain at the forefront of people's minds for the foreseeable future, because again, the prize is large, which means that people will be thinking about how to innovate past the current stock, I think indefinitely, which means that investing in the sector is going to be difficult. And we can see that, for example, in the solar sector, that innovation has persisted, but the stocks themselves have become susceptible to competition from their peers. And I think that that is also an additional risk with some of these cryptocurrency investments. And I think with that musing, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.